Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
This is You, the Owner's Manual podcast on RadioMD, iHeart, or wherever you download it from. Thanks very much for downloading it. We are the show that gives you the information that you need to live at the top of your curve till near the end. One of those questions we often get asked is, where are we in stem cells? Should we go there? They've told me it's good for my knee. Should I do that? What about the fact that it's not covered by insurance? What does that mean? Well, we're going to get all those answers today from someone who's studied it intensively. Lee Turner is an associate professor at the University of Minnesota Center for Bioethics, the School of Public Health, and the College of Pharmacy. He's co-editor of Risks and Challenges in Medical Tourism, Understanding the Global Market for Health Services, and The View from Here, Bioethics and the Social Sciences. He is author of numerous publications, and no one, I think, knows more about stem cells and their commercialization than Lee Turner. So, Lee, thanks very much for being on the show.
Hi, thanks for taking time to talk to me today. I appreciate it.
So this is podcast 920B of You, the Owner's Manual. Of course, the A segment is the news of the week and what it means to you. Lee, let's talk about stem cells. So I had a patient come to me and she said, my knee is creaky and it's getting harder to walk. A friend of mine said that stem cells, she had an injection of stem cells and it worked wonders. What's the data on that, and why is it not covered by insurance, or is it covered by insurance?
Sure. So, you know, what you're describing is a fairly common kind of scenario where someone has a problem like you've described, you know, an orthopedic problem or musculoskeletal problem, and they've heard that there's a stem cell intervention that may help them. They kind of get an anecdotal account from a friend or a family member, and they decide to look into it. And, you know, it's one of these things where when you look across the United States and look at businesses making claims about stem cell treatments, you know, the kind of case you've described is really one of the most dominant kinds of marketing claims that's out there. So it's, you know, you can see an awful lot of orthopedic clinics, sports medicine clinics, pain management facilities that will claim to have safe and effective stem cell therapies for individuals who have things like, you know, knee problems or knee pain. And, you know, the problem is that when you look at the data that's out there, I mean, obviously it depends in part on what you consider meaningful evidence. But, you know, I would say that we're really not there yet in terms of having, you know, compelling, conclusive safety and efficacy data to indicate that a woman like someone like the woman you meant can go to a business and have a true stem cell therapy and benefit from it. So instead, there's a lot of uncertainty. Like, for example, she could go to a clinic and not be administered stem cells at all. She may end up getting cellular debris or adult cells that aren't really stem cells. So this is another one of these areas where you have marketing claims and often the evidence isn't there to actually back it up. And that's why that connects to your point about insurance or lack of insurance. People often have to pay or typically pay on an out-of-pocket basis. And that's because public and private insurers don't provide reimbursement for these kinds of procedures. And it's because the evidence isn't there yet.
Now, let's go back and say, so one of the things that we see often in sports medicine clinics and that some is insured and some is not is what is called PRP, platelet-rich plasma. And then and you wonder, well, does this work or not? And you look in the literature and you can't find any data on randomized controlled trials. And what you find is the orthopedics department and often at even Cleveland Clinic will do this. Or sports medicine docs caring for example, the Atlanta Falcons do this. And you say, if you're a patient, well, why shouldn't I have that? And why doesn't insurance cover it? And you say then from the physician, I'm an internist standpoint, referring patients, you say, why don't we have data that some of these things work? Why aren't there more studies on this?
Right. Well, I mean, I think I've focused less in my work looking at businesses making claims about PRP than themselves, but I'm glad you mentioned it because I think there are some interesting parallels. I mean, you know, plenty of the companies making direct-to-consumer advertising claims that I follow, they'll kind of make dual claims, and so they'll market so-called stem cell therapies, but they'll also market PRP or platelet-rich plasma and for often the same indications, orthopedic pain relief, sports medicine, and so on. And you have this, very similar kind of gap where you have very robust, strong form marketing claims, often, very persuasive, compelling marketing techniques that as you mentioned, high-profile athletes have had this procedure and benefited. NFL or former NFL players or Major League Baseball players have had it and done well as a result. Sometimes you can even find testimonials by professional or kind of ex-professional athletes talking about how this has helped them. And then if you say, okay, well, I found some YouTube videos or I found some testimonials or I found a Facebook page that's making all these reassuring statements, but, let's now go look and see what kind of the peer-reviewed literature says, then you kind of find yourself going down the path you mentioned, which is that, if you go and look and say, I'd like to see if there's a randomized controlled trial that provides conclusive evidence of safety and efficacy, you don't really find it with PRP. And so, I mean, you can find a number of studies, but often there's some pretty significant problems with the studies themselves. They're kind of, some limitations. They're not blinded. They're not randomized. It's kind of low-grade evidence. And I think that's why these claims kind of float around. I mean, it's sort of, they're not really evidence-based in some sort of conclusive, robust way. But you can find these anecdotal accounts, and sometimes you can find these, earlier stage clinical studies, like say a phase one study where, there's some, it appears at least on the surface to be safe. The authors will sometimes, say that there's some evidence suggestive of efficacy. And then that gets used to tell a story about how, we know this helps people. And so I think there are some parallels between PRP and stem cells in terms of kind of using modest amounts of data and on top of that, building this whole pyramid of advertising claims and hyperbole, even though at its foundation, there's not really, conclusive, powerful evidence. And part of this is just driven by people's, hope, desperation. People have health problems. They're looking for something to relieve it. And if you have businesses out there making reassuring claims, I mean, there's kind of a ready-made audience out there looking for relief of some kind.
So now with PRP, is there one of the reasons you got involved in looking at the stem cell clinics and whether they are effective or not is as you broaden the use from injections into the knee and into the hip to into other places, there seems to be more risk. What do we know first about that risk and is that true? Is there risk with the other than a wallet biopsy, if you will, is there risk in the stem cell injections into joints?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think you're making an important point, which is, I think what you're getting at is that mode of administration, the way in which you're administering something to someone, whether it's PRP or a so-called stem cell intervention or something else, the way in which it's delivered, where it's delivered, makes a difference. So behind the scenes, patients often aren't going to be aware of this, but there's going to be, there's going to be some way in which cells and tissues are being obtained, whether it's from that person or from some other individual. There's going to be processing that's going on. So if it's cells taken from fat, for example, many clinics that market stem cell treatments will have to use an enzyme or ultrasonic cavitation. They'll have to do something to break apart that fat. So there's a lot going on before anything is put back into a person. If, as I said, even if it's an autologous process, with going from that person being processed and coming back into them. And then there's kind of the moment that you mentioned, which is that, there's kind of injecting it into joints or sort of specific locations like that. But it's also possible to do things like you can find businesses that will make claims about injecting purported stem cell interventions directly into people's heads, to their brains, or into their spinal cord, spinal column. Into intravenous infusion. So the idea that it's going to be, kind of circulated through the body. And so, you're right that the mode of administration can make a difference in terms of degree of risk. So there's the way in which cells have been obtained, way in which they've been processed, way in which they're being delivered. And these various steps can increase or decrease the likelihood of a serious complication taking place. And so, you know, this is actually where it gets quite challenging to look at the whole direct-to-consumer marketplace, because if you look at what the businesses will claim, you know, they'll often make very reassuring claims about the safety of what they're doing and how helpful it is. And it's clear that when things go wrong, you know, typically we're learning about that, not from the business themselves, but because, you know, a patient has managed to find an investigative reporter who gets interested in that person's story and begins to dig and realizes that, you know, very serious complication has occurred. Some of them we know about because people have filed civil lawsuits. And sometimes it's the money out of the wallet that you mentioned that people have had financial losses, but in other cases it's you know, the allegations that quite serious injuries have happened. There's case reports, there's case theories by doctors who have had to treat, you know, often very complex cases where people have had major health problems as a result of going to these businesses, and then problems are dumped in the lap of other doctors.
So let's drop back for a second, if I can, Lee.
Sure.
And say, okay, so now you're a 72-year-old person with with severe knee problems, and the doc says, we could try PRP, or we can do a knee replacement. PRP is platelet-rich plasma, and he says, we don't know of any long-term risks. You could get an infection because we're injecting it. You could get a deep vein thrombosis, but you can get both of those with a knee replacement as well.
Yeah.
Let's try the PRP first. Unfortunately, it's not covered by insurance. There's a $1,900 charge or something. What do you do in that case if you're the patient?
Well, I mean, I think it's a... I guess the first question is, you know, if a clinician is offering that kind of advice, is it good clinical advice to offer? Is there enough, you know, safety data and efficacy data behind PRP to actually say this is good advice to give to somebody? So I think it's worth asking, is that an appropriate way to kind of frame these interventions for someone? It sounds like an appealing message, right? Like, let's try this other thing before having a joint replacement. It's an attractive message, but you want it to be something meaningful that's being offered to people. Not just something that's basically a, you know, kind of costly placebo. On the other side, you know, when it comes to the patient, I think it's a moment to pause and ask questions. And so, you know, I think there's a good chance there to ask a doctor, you know, tell me more about this procedure. Why are you recommending it? What's the data in terms of its safety? What's the data in terms of the, you know, the likelihood that it's actually going to provide therapeutic benefits? It's going to be efficacious. And I would say that,
okay, so you know as much about this as, you know about as much about this as anyone, Lee. So let's just say that the orthopod says, in fact, there are no randomized trials of knee replacement or of this, but both seem to relieve pain, and at least I have a lot of patients who can avoid knee replacements for several years, and who knows, by then, stem cells may be beneficial. What do you do at that point if you're the patient?
Well, I mean, I think I would carry on with the point that I made that, I mean, the way you're couching it, it sounds attractive, and it sounds like, you know, the sensible option is to go with PRP. And so, you know, how information is framed and delivered matters a lot. And so I can understand if that's the message someone hears, you know, the line of reason they're going to follow is, why not? Sure, I'll try PRP. We'll see if it works. Maybe it'll delay when I require a joint replacement down the road. If I have to, I'll have that. So I can see how, you know, kind of the train of logic, train of reasoning could be, why not? Let's give PRP a try. And if it's a modest price, you know, thousands of dollars rather than tens of thousands of dollars, maybe someone will say, even if insurance isn't covering it, then I'll go ahead and have this. But, you know, I think the points that I was trying to make about kind of a process of gathering information and a process of decision-making are still worth thinking about, that, you know, ask lots of questions of a doctor. If it's a primary care physician, a specialist, there's a moment here. It's people's body. It's their lives. It's their health. It's their money. It's perfectly reasonable to ask questions. And I would also say beyond that, you know, it's not always easy to obtain, but whenever, wherever possible, going and getting a second opinion is a valuable thing to do, because a different doctor may provide information, may frame information in a different way. And I think that can be useful in terms of helping people make not just decisions, but informed decisions.
We're talking with Lee Turner, who's an associate professor at the University of Minnesota Center for Bioethics, the School of Public Health, and College of Pharmacy. He's co-editor of Risks and Challenges in Medical Tourism, Understanding the Global Market for Health Services. Let me quickly switch to stem cells and medical tourism. Now, one of the things you point out is that I think these clinics are located in upscale areas, such as more in California, in Southern California, in Florida, and in Texas than in other parts of the country. Is this because this is where people can afford it? Is this because this is where people are gullible? Is this because this is where the stem cell research is done? Why do we have them located in those areas?
Yeah, so those are all terrific questions and something that, I've definitely spent time thinking about it. It's hard to say, kind of offer a clear causal pathway or explanation in terms of why we see these businesses clustering in certain parts of the state. But, first of all, let me just emphasize that you're right. I mean, what you've offered is an accurate account that you can find businesses involved in making direct-to-consumer marketing claims about stem cell therapies, across the United States. So the last published study I did, I found 45 distinct states where you can find clinics making these direct-to-consumer advertising claims. Some of them, like you mentioned, stem cell therapies, so-called stem cell therapies for joints or pain. In other instances, purported treatments for ALS, MS, Parkinson's disease, spinal cord injuries. Sometimes extremely strong form claims where there's not good data at all for these interventions. As far as where they're located, the second big study I did on this topic, I found a large number, over 100, 125 clinics in California, 160 in Florida, 100 Texas. Those are the triple digit states, and then 56 Arizona, 45 Colorado. And it raises this question, as you mentioned, why do we see this concentration in some states and not in others? I think the gullible point is one that can be dismissed fairly quickly because, I really think it's important not to think about individuals who go to these businesses as being, kind of gullible, easily duped. I think any one of us, if we had a serious enough health problem, it's easy to imagine a situation where we go on the internet, look for something that might help us, find an attractive website making powerful claims, and begin to think this is something that we should look into. And I don't think that's about being gullible. It's not about being stupid or easily misled. Plenty of people who are savvy, intelligent, thoughtful, begin exploring these things, and often it's because they've got very serious health problems there that they're grappling with. So I think it's important to kind of imagine ourselves in their shoes and what it must be like trying to navigate an often, confusing marketplace, almost like a sea of misinformation. As far as, certain states, as I said, it's challenging to think of, what are the good answers to that question. But I have to say, an awful lot of the clinics I've found, if you go back a couple of years, you can see that they call themselves stem cell clinics now, but a couple of years ago, they were maybe, laser liposuction clinic, a cosmetic surgery spa, a cosmetic surgery clinic. And so in part, what we might be seeing is in places like California and Florida, where you have a lot of cosmetic surgery clinics, some of them are just rebranding and reappearing as purported stem cell clinics. So if you have a kind of a clinical ecosystem of cosmetic surgery clinics, for example, that might be a basis. It may be that businesses go where there's going to be a large market. So you have this concentration in, major urban centers like Los Angeles and San Diego and other places through Florida, Texas, and elsewhere.
Now,
money matters,
before
right?
Before we sign off, I want to make sure that people understand there is some danger in this when the stem cells are used, especially for more than a peripheral joint. So one of the things you investigated was a number of people going blind from injections in the eye and the retina for macular degeneration. A number of problems if they get injected in the wrong way. Do you want to just comment on that briefly? We've got 1 minute left.
Well, just to say, I'm appreciative that you mentioned this point, that people can lose a lot of money, but they can also have very serious health problems. So there are documented reports of women who've gone to clinics. They began suffering from vision loss. They come out blinded because they've had stem cell procedures that have basically destroyed their vision. Other cases that come to mind, instances of stroke, pulmonary embolism. So, you're right that there are cases where It's not just people spending money and maybe in the end feeling like they've been scammed. There are other instances where we've got, you know, documented accounts where people had a health problem, thought I've got nothing to lose, and it turned out they had a great deal to lose because they ended up spending not just money, but ended up being far worse off as a result of going to these businesses. So I think that's another cautionary note for people to keep in mind.
So the solution Dr. Turner recommends in the book, if you will, or the co-editor of Risks and Challenges in Medical Tourism, Understanding the Global Market for Health Services, is in fact that you make sure you go to an academic center, make sure you ask questions about alternatives and risks and benefits. And then I think it's obviously much more reliable to get procedures that are insurance paid, because then at least you know that the insurance company has looked carefully at it. What happens when you got a desperate problem? Well, then you've got to make the risk benefit decision for yourself. But remember, there are risks. We've been talking to Dr. Lee Turner, T-U-R-N-E-R, associate professor at the University of Minnesota School of Bioethics and School of Public Health, Minnesota Center for Bioethics, School of Public Health, and College of Pharmacy. You've been listening to You, the Owner's Manual, podcast 920B. Thanks very much for downloading us. Tell your friends about us, and we'll be back next week. We have a great guest next week. The guest next week is going to be Tali Landau-Aronoff talking about her book, Hell and Back. It's actually a very funny book, as you can guess from the title. She is a physician and a pediatric ENT surgeon who developed breast cancer, and her stories about her recovery from breast cancer, divorce, are very, very entertaining, but also illuminate a lot about medicine. To Hell and Back. Actually, there's no to Hell and Back. It's just Hell and Back. Wife and mother, doctor and patient, dragon slayer, Tali Landau-Aronoff. Thanks very much for listening to us. Darian, thanks for wonderful engineering, but especially you for downloading us, and do rate us. Thanks again.